Attention, please. Would Logan Air passengers please proceed to the aircraft?
Fly with me. Oh, won't you fly with me? We'll fly off to the island. And watch the setting sun.
Hello, I'm Joe Mellis, and welcome to Logan Air's Flight Log, where I get to go behind the scenes of the UK's largest regional airline to find answers for your questions and discover exactly what it takes to keep Logan Air in the air and put that on air. This is episode 5, and this time out, we're chatting with Logan Air's Chief Operations Officer, Maurice Boyle. Thanks for coming on, Maurice. You've certainly had a rich and varied career in aviation. Take us on a whistle-stop tour from then to now, if you like.
Okay, John. Well, last Saturday was my 65th birthday, so I've been in aviation for 47 years now, and I got in by accident. When I was a youngster, I went to St. Augustine's School in Edinburgh, and left school, didn't want to go to university at the time, no interest in that, and actually went into retail with John Lewis Partnership, which is a great organisation, but soon decided that retail wasn't for me, and I went back to college to do my hires, and well, do some more hires, actually, and then my cousins were working at Edinburgh Airport at the time on a holiday job, so I went along for a holiday job, and they said, well, there's no holiday job, but there's a job in the cargo warehouse. And I kind of started there, and this is in the days of typewriters and all the rest of it, and all the documentation in air cargo was laborious and painstaking, typing out things called airway bills, that every piece of cargo had to have one. And I just was fascinated by it. I loved it. I'd actually been in the air cadets when I was a kid and wanted to fly, but then when I went for the sort of medical, it was like the eyesight then. You had to have sort of perfect eyesight, and I didn't have that. And I didn't really pursue it, so unfortunately, I kind of went off on a different tangent, and then I came back into the airport when I was 19 and thought, oh, this is interesting, and I really enjoyed it. And through that, I then went to Aberdeen in 1978 with a company called Dan Air, which was one of the big UK charter airlines at the time, and they'd got in on the start of the oil boom in the 70s, taking the workers to Shetland and then onwards to the rigs. And I was hired as what's called a loadmaster, which is a guy that flies on cargo planes and makes sure that the plane's loaded correctly and the paperwork's correct for the pilots. And the original intention was I would do a year in Aberdeen and then go on what was then a big plane called a 707, and you'd do global cargo. And I thought, this is going to be great fun. But after a year, the company got rid of those big planes. So I stayed in Aberdeen for 4 years working, you know, on the oil runs up and down to Shetland. And then we also had contracts for Ford, taking car parts all around Europe, Royal Mail, mail flights at night, and also drilling equipment all over Europe. And we also had a fascinating contract with, I think I can talk about it now, but it was British Nuclear Fuels, because we used to take the type of plane 748 into Dounreay and pick up a 4.5-ton box containing plutonium fuel rods and take them down to, they were going to Sellafield. And then from Sellafield, or they would either go into Carlisle or Liverpool and then take them all over Europe. And we had to fly a very circuitous route everywhere, avoiding going over centres of population and all that. And that was quite fascinating at the time. But that kind of got me into the aviation at the sharp end. And then I moved into the ground, and I moved to Gatwick Airport in 1982. And then I got into management. My first management job was in 1985 in Belfast. And that was right at the height of the Ulster Says No campaign, if I recall. And that was quite an interesting time to be in. Living and working in Northern Ireland. From then, I progressed through a number of other airlines, but I didn't really get into sort of senior management until it was the mid-90s, and I ran a big handling organisation in Gatwick. But the common thread, I would say I've worked in a number of facets of commercial aviation. So I've done cargo airlines, passenger, holiday flying, and I spent a bit of time in the Middle East with DHL delivering the mail for the US military to Iraq and Afghanistan. That's about a decade ago, which again was just fascinating. I mean, that like literally was like some of the places I've been was like a scene out of a movie. You know, when you go to Camp Bastion and you see what's going on in the ground, and then when you see what the Americans have in some of their bases, and it is, you can see why America's the kind of power it is, because they have just unlimited, it would appear, you know, sort of aviation assets. They have sort of a plane for everything, and but anyway, delivering the mail was vitally important for them. Getting the mail through to their troops in the front line, and every job I've had in aviation's always had I've had an engagement personally with it. So I really it mattered to me that we delivered the mail on time, because it's somebody in America that's sending the parcels to their kids in Iraq or Afghanistan, and it's important. And similarly, now in Loganair, it's really important when we serve the communities that we serve that we deliver. And my job, maybe talk about that in more depth, is it's all about delivery. You know, that's my whole ethos is in the something I learned in DHL, it's all about delivery. It's like managing a football team. You're only as good as last week's result. You're only as good as yesterday's performance.
Absolutely. Some amazing roles there. I mean, it sounds like you've seen pretty much all there is to see in aviation inside and out, and exceptionally well-versed in operational challenges. But I'm wondering, how did the impacts of COVID differ in this instance?
Well, that you're flattering me by saying I've seen a lot in aviation. Yes, I have. But COVID completely, as you say, it took the nation, the world by surprise. We had to act really fast in Loganair to kind of cut our programs right back, because the demand, literally, people were not allowed to travel. We did maintain lifeline services. I mean, we've always been a lifeline to the islands. And we did cut a very basic program that enabled us to serve every destination at least once a day. But we also then had to make tough decisions. We used the furlough scheme extensively for our staff, and we had a very small amount of redundancies. And I'm pleased to say everyone that, certainly in the pilot community, we had a few redundancies, but everyone that was made redundant was rehired, and, you know, if they wanted to come back at the end of the pandemic. But going into the pandemic, it was a fight for survival, both commercially and operationally. We had to cut our cloth quite severely. A chance conversation with the Scottish Air Ambulance Service led us to end up with two of our Saab mini airliners converted into ambulances to enable them to carry COVID patients from the islands, because at the time there was some concerns about the aircraft they were using, and we would be able to provide a bigger aircraft and sort out things like separate the air conditioning from where the patient was from the cockpit. And we were able to respond quite quickly and work in parallel with the Scottish Air Ambulance Service to deliver that. And we provided that service for, it must have been about 18 months, I think. You know, we weren't flying every day, but the fact that they had it, and then as COVID evolved and the understanding of the disease, you know, the clinicians realized that we don't need to bring everybody into the Central Belt or to Aberdeen for treatment. There's ways of dealing with it. But certainly having that service available to them is a big reassurance to the Scottish Air Ambulance Service. But COVID was, if you think going into it was hard, coming out of it was probably harder, because the ramp up there was a ramp up, and then there was a kind of a false start, because, you know, there was that second wave of COVID, and that really caused some issues, because we thought the demand was there, and then everyone got locked down again. But hugely challenging. But coming out of it, particularly last year, the demand was strong, and the whole industry, I think, struggled to ramp up to cope with the demand of summer 22. And I think the listeners will appreciate that, you know, the airport experience was not in all cases as smooth as we would like it from a number of aspects, particularly passengers with reduced mobility and wheelchairs. The airport struggled to recruit people back into the airport campus. So it wasn't like Loganair got this wrong or that airport got that wrong. It was everybody struggled with certain aspects of the customer journey, and largely due to not having the right number of staff in the right places at the right time. Our whole focus for summer 23 now is working towards a better customer experience and a more resilient operational delivery, recognizing that perhaps not all the pieces of the puzzle will be 100% resourced.
I think it's an honest admission. And when you were talking there about COVID, I know people like me and people in my industry tend to over-exaggerate, but you literally were providing a lifeline to people that were on the islands. But also, we've recognized in past episodes of Flight Log, Loganair was especially well positioned to come out of COVID in terms of its finances, because you were able to pivot and offer these services during COVID and still retain a level of income that allowed you to come out of COVID possibly better than some of the other airlines.
I think that's kind of a credit to our CEO and my colleagues and the senior management team, because pre-COVID, we had an international network. It became obvious straight away with COVID that flying internationally was going to be problematic, that we would be flying empty aeroplanes. So we kind of slashed the international network and focused, pivoted back into the UK and said, well, we've got to do the lifeline services. We're going to have to mothball some aircraft. We're going to have to furlough the staff and then work on a plan to come back out of it. And the airline that's come out of COVID is different. We've sort of preserved the good old Loganair values, but we have been more, just had to be astute and make decisions quite quickly. And I think that benefited us. Obviously, at the start of COVID, there was the collapse of the original Flybe. And that was a tragedy for the employees, but we saw some opportunities there that COVID kind of, we couldn't exploit those opportunities straight away, but we thought, well, there are some routes that we can serve that fit in with our portfolio, kind of expanding the Loganair brand south of the border into key markets like Southampton, which is a key destination for us now for Edinburgh and Glasgow, both leisure traffic and a lot of business traffic on that route, a lot of defence traffic because of the ships that are built on the Clyde and the things like that. And the business model has changed slightly, but we've never forgotten what our core business is. You know, we still fly the Twin Otter to Barra to land on the beach. We have, and again, part of my job is the complexities of planning the network. I take the commercial plan, if you like, and turn it into operational reality, and then replicate that up to 250 times a day in the peak. So we're actually flying more legs, more flights a day than the likes of Virgin Atlantic, which everyone thinks is a very big airline, and it is. We have more planes, I think, than Virgin Atlantic, but our planes fly 8 to 10 legs a day, whereas maybe a Virgin airplane might fly, you know, out to America and come back later. So the whole pace of the operation is different to a long haul airline. It's getting the model right and then repeating it and repeating it and repeating it. So the Formula One pit stop is the kind of what we aspire to on the ground. The industry struggled to do that last year, but we're working with our service partners and to deliver that type of experience to customers. So when a plane lands, we know that it'll be spun in 30 minutes and be off again safely and efficiently with everybody happily, hopefully getting to their destinations on time.
Some of these calculations that you're talking about are not what would have been worked out in the back of a cigarette packet, as my father would have said. They sound very, very intensive and complex and challenging, and we'll come on to that in a little bit. But I'm just wondering, from your own experience working in aviation since the 70s, you must have seen some huge technological advancements.
Absolutely. And in some ways, the hardware has changed out of all recognition. In some ways, it's not as interesting because back in when I started, a lot of the aeroplanes that I worked with were designed and built in Britain. You know, I started in the era of the Vickers Viscount, the Vickers Vanguard, the de Havilland Comet, the VC-10, all these planes, VAC-111, these were the Avro 748. You know, Britain had a big manufacturing base, if you will, in commercial aviation. That's pretty much gone now. The sort of medium-sized jets are either Boeing 737s or Airbuses, and it's quite hard to tell the difference. And then the Loganair fleet is actually more characterful. So you've still got the two islanders up in Orkney that take kids to school and the bank manager around the Orkneys. And, you know, they can't, there's nothing to beat that type of aeroplane. Then we have the Twin Otters that serve Barra, Tyree and Campbelltown that operate on behalf of a public service obligation flying, as we call it. And again, that's a unique aeroplane. And then the mainstream fleet comprises, we've just over the past 3 years doing a rollover out of the venerable Saab 340, which has been a superb regional airliner, 33 to 36 seater. And we're replacing them with the ATR, which is a French-Italian aircraft. And that's been in production for a few years, but that's the replacement, slightly bigger. But again, a very good aeroplane. And then the other component of the Loganair fleet is the Embraer regional jet, of which we fly 13. And that, again, connects the business centres in Scotland with the south of England. And it is slightly faster and gives us so we can serve markets further afield with the jet. But the bulk of the fleet is the new ATRs, and they're more efficient in terms of, and their carbon footprint is smaller as well. So that's a key factor in what we do. But yes, apart from the hardware changes, there's the biggest change I've seen is in the customer experience. So in the old days, when you turned up for your package holiday, you would turn up at the airport and there'd be queues out the door with people with suitcases waiting to get a piece of paper, boarding pass and all that stuff. Well, that's all changed now, or largely has changed, because of the introduction of technology. So you can buy your ticket on your phone. You can check in on your phone. If you don't have a bag to check, you can go straight to the gate and bypass some of that. Now, certain things are slightly more onerous. You know, security is quite rightly a lot more rigorous than it was when I began in aviation. And that's for obvious reasons. We've got to protect our customers from external threats. Overall, the customer experience has been enhanced, although I would recognise that, you know, the so-called golden age of aviation is perhaps when it was the elite that travelled, is perhaps changed. And that's been brought about by the low-cost carriers and pioneers like Loganair, I would say. You know, we have done quite a lot of innovation to improve customer service in our own way here in Scotland and in our domestic network.
You mentioned, you know, some of these apps and things that can get you through quicker than ever. But the other side of that, what you were talking about was the under the wing, I think was the term that you used, hasn't changed that much in the time that you've been in aviation.
Yeah, that's one of the things I find quite interesting, because if you look at the shipping industry and, you know, in the old days it would take, you know, ships would arrive in the tide and maybe take a day to unload and then a day to load. And nowadays with containerization, the ships are literally turning in hours and in and out in the tide. Aircraft, with the exception of when they brought in jumbo jets and baggage was containerized, the smaller airliners, the luggage for the customers comes to a check-in desk, their luggage is separated from the customer, goes through a screening process, then has to be manually handled and loaded on the plane. We still push the planes back with tractors. It's a process that the guys that I worked with at Edinburgh Airport in 1977 would recognise. And in a way, there have been some advances, but we're now moving into all electric ground equipment. And we've just invested in a big fleet of loading equipment for our Royal Mail mail flights to simplify the loading process. And that's a fairly modest step forward technologically, because it probably exists in other industries. But I think there is scope to perhaps improve that going forward, both to make equipment greener and more efficient. It's just one of those things that's quite interesting. You know, anyone from 50 years ago would recognize the process, whereas in other industries, things are totally, totally different.
Yeah, but I mean, the end of the day, you still need people to make all of this work, I suppose. You mentioned there the sort of green credentials for Loganair. We've previously heard about the Green Skies environmental programme through Loganair on an earlier episode. How does that translate into your role for operations?
Well, obviously, fuel conservation is one of our biggest expenses from an economic point of view, is the cost of jet fuel. So it's in our interest to manage that wisely. And we do a number of things in terms of when we plan flight routings. We want to plan the most direct routings for the aircraft. I'll give you an example from Dundee to London City. We take off from Dundee and then we go out to the West Coast, because most of the traffic in the UK goes southbound down the West Coast and northbound up the East Coast. So we have to navigate across and down and then back in. That's why the journey southbound takes about 15 minutes longer than the northbound. But we work with National Air Traffic Services to always try and optimise the routings to minimise the time and the distance that we fly. And then within that space, we then work with the air crew to manage the fuel consumption of the aircraft. So we look at things like, wherever possible, do a single engine taxi. So the plane will taxi out. You might have seen this in some aircraft you fly on. We'll taxi out in one engine and then start the other engine just before takeoff. So you're not unnecessarily burning fuel and increasing your CO2 footprint. And then the other thing we're looking at, which is, so my area is very much focused on the here and now and managing the aircraft that we operate as efficiently and effectively as possible, working with stakeholders to fly the plan as effectively as possible. And then beyond that space, we've got a team looking at the future in terms of battery power, hydrogen power. Hydrogen power has some, it looks quite good. And then sustainable aviation fuel, which is the other thing that is kind of a lot of airlines are beginning to utilize. But again, because we operate the Islanders and smaller aircraft, the future starts small, you know. So battery powered aircraft and hydrogen powered aircraft will start with small aircraft, because some of this technology will be hard to scale. So that's why the big airlines are looking at sustainable aviation fuel, because that's something that you can operate a current airliner, a large airliner with. But the real benefit will come through the new technologies, which start on small aircraft and then scale up. And we're working with a number of partners, Cranfield University and other stakeholders, to develop that in a real world environment. We're not there yet to implement. So no one's going to be flying on a hydrogen powered Islander this year, but it's within our grasp, you know, in the next few years.
Yeah, you can see where it's going to be. If you don't mind me saying, Maurice, you sound like someone who actually, and it's a rare thing, this, and it's lovely to come across, you sound like someone who has a passion for and a love for aviation as an experience from a young boy through to now. I can see a twinkle in your eyes when you talk about it. Is that a correct sort of observation of you?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been very fortunate that I kind of fell into aviation by accident, but it was kind of meant to be. And I've had a number of ups and downs in my career, but I would say more ups than downs. And I've managed to travel the world. I worked in the Middle East. I then went back to the Middle East and to Abu Dhabi, worked with Etihad, a big global carrier at the time, we had 108 nationalities of pilots. Can you imagine trying to manage 108 nationalities in the cockpit? And my job was at the time was head of pilot performance. So it was all about standard procedures because you can't afford any misunderstandings if you've got different nationalities in the cockpit. But it was a fascinating time to be there. And then I worked in Poland for a year doing what I call a renovation project on the former state airline. And Poland's very much in the news just now with the refugees coming in from Ukraine. But Poland's a fantastic country. And I lived there for a year, again, only about a decade ago, and worked with that airline to help modernize it and its policies and procedures and approach to how they transformed themselves from a kind of former state industry where not efficient, not effective, into a more productive and progressive customer-focused airline. Fascinating. And then back in the UK, I ran a charter airline 20 years ago. And again, every job I've had has my biggest fear now, to be honest, is, as I said, I was 65 last week, and I'm a bit worried about what I'm going to do when I retire. So my wife's a bit concerned that I'm planning not to retire, but that day will come. But I've got a lot to do before then. And summer 23 is uppermost in my mind to deliver the best customer experience, the best operational performance, and have our pilots and cabin crew and engineers and employees enjoying what they do, because last year was quite tough at some times. And it's trying to get that sense of the joy and the fun that aviation can be back into it, because it has, as you can imagine, 40, 50 years ago, it was a slightly different environment. It's trying to inject that passion. And most people that come into aviation get the buzz, get the kick, they smell the jet fuel and they think, this is fun. Mm. It's not so much fun at 2 o'clock in the morning and in Inverness when you're unloading a mail plane in a gale, or up in Shetland where our teams have to deal with that. Like last week, 100 mile an hour winds. I mean, we just, in the old days, we would perhaps try to keep working when it wasn't sensible to do so. Nowadays, we're much more, right, this is getting a bit too sporty. Let's just slow everything down, keep it safe and make sure that we'll get our customers there. Most of our customers respect and understand the extreme weather that we face in Scotland, and the pilots get the most fantastic flying experiences they'll have in their career. Many of them go on to fly jumbo jets and all the rest of it, but they can never replicate the experience and the fun of, on a great day, there's nowhere better to be than flying around the highlands and islands of Scotland.
Absolutely. Just in the here and now, you've spoken a lot about perfecting that service model for 2023 and through summer. But what would you say are the sort of key characteristics to your role and the secret to making the operation slick?
I kind of report to the CEO, Jonathan Hinkles, and then he entrusts me to sort of deliver the operation on a day-to-day basis. You start with a good plan and you execute it, and then in the course of the day, things can happen. So you plan for, well, what happens if this happens? What happens if this? You always have to have a plan B, a plan C, hopefully a plan D. And once you've got the plan, then you communicate that plan to all the stakeholders and you work it through I work through my head of operations and through my director of flight operations, who manages the pilot community. We communicate the plan so everyone understands the game plan, and we say, this is the plan that we plan to execute, but here's plan B, plan C. The customer is uppermost in our mind. Sometimes plans don't go according to plan. And as I say, you either have normally we hope to have a good plan, and sometimes a good plan can go bad. But if you have a bad plan and it goes bad, that's even worse. So through experience, we can refine things, and we'll say, well, and one of the features of 2022, there was a lot of irregular things happened that even I hadn't experienced. We had airports running out of fuel because there was if you remember, there was some protesters that were blockading the refineries. Most airports don't hold large stocks of aviation fuel on site. So Edinburgh, Glasgow, Birmingham, they are dependent on, you know, just-in-time supplies of fuel. So any hiccups to there, and then all of a sudden, no, you can't pick up fuel. These things, we hadn't really seen that on a regular basis, and we did see that last year. And we saw some other, you know, short-term closures of airports because of perhaps a problem with the runway. You know, they had to fill out a pothole, and that happens. But it was happening a few times last year. Hopefully, it won't happen so much this year. So being prepared for eventualities and having a plan B and C. And then finally, we have a graduated system for what we call a regular operation. So in terms of, we have a level 1, 2, 3, so everyone understands how to respond. And it's very much based on how fire and rescue and police and local authorities have kind of bronze, silver, gold to various events. And we have a similar sort of a triage system so that we can bring people in to support the ops team when things go wrong. So I'll give you an example. Last week when we had Storm Otto, and that really impacted Aberdeen. I mean, for the whole of the morning, Aberdeen is our Heathrow. We have a dozen aircraft based there, flying for all sorts of customers, our own scheduled service customers, our oil and gas customers, and our Royal Mail customer. And Aberdeen, we couldn't fly for the whole morning. So that causes a big problem. So we immediately declare that as a significant event. How do we look after the customers? How do we protect the customers? How do we manage the crew? And when are we going to start flying again? So we have all that documented and pretty well exercised, because we're, you know, every day is different. So we've got pretty good plans, and you combine the processes with the experience and with the passion of the staff. And that's the winning formula, is having robust processes, but also having that passion to deliver day in, day out, and getting a kick out of it is important for our people, in maintaining that enthusiasm, which does exist in Loganair, because it's what I call a big little airline. So I've worked for some big global carriers where you are literally a number, and the policies are decided the other side of the world. In Loganair, if I pull a lever, you know, I can make something happen quite quickly. You know, I know the names of the pilots. I know the names of our cabin crew, our frontline staff. So does this, all the leadership team. We know each other. And that helps when the going gets tough, because people do, as I say, I'm mixing my metaphors a bit, but people do put their shoulder to the wheel if they know that they're not just a number. And even though Loganair is a significantly bigger airline than I joined it 8 years ago, we've by and large managed to maintain that kind of family feel. I make a joke that I sometimes say it might sometimes feel like a dysfunctional family, but it's still family. and that's largely true, you know, and I'm not saying that in disrespecting any other airlines, but it's the way we want to try and keep it, because that's how you get the best performance.
You don't get that from sitting in your big chair up in the big office. You must be on the shop floor a lot of the time.
Yes, I think that was one of the challenges with the pandemic, was actually by law you weren't allowed to go places. And I must admit, I used to sneak through from my home in Edinburgh to Glasgow on a regular basis on the back of, we were doing this ambulance project with the Scottish Air Ambulance Service. But you have to get out and about, because there's no substitute for, you can't run the airline from the headquarters here in Glasgow. You can manage it, but actually I drop into Edinburgh, it's my home airport, regularly, and we try and get round the network, fly on the aircraft to see people. Like I say, when I worked back in the Middle East delivering the mail, I went everywhere in Iraq and Afghanistan. And one of my colleagues, it was quite funny at the time, it was the head engineer, and I said, "So have you been to Baghdad or Balad or wherever it was?" He said, "Oh no, I'm not going there, it's dangerous." I said, "But you're serving the crew, that you're maintaining those aeroplanes, you need to see the environment." So you have to get out and about, and we all do. And particularly in the summer, but the winter's all, this period in time now, February, is about getting ready for summer and gearing up. And then we'll get out on the road and communicate with the guys. We do a podcast every week, and I do a bit of my outside broadcast from somewhere windswept and interesting, hopefully, and just try and show people that we're not just a bunch of suits that sit in Glasgow. Funnily enough, that was the one benefit of the pandemic. We ditched the suits and a slightly more relaxed dress code in the office, because we're always on duty, pretty much. It's not a 9-to-5 job running an airline, that's for sure.
Maurice, thanks for joining us. I'm Joe Mellis, and that was episode 5 of Loganair's Flight Log, where we take the big issues of being in the air and put them on air. On our next Flight Log, just what sort of calculations go into working out how much fuel is needed for a flight? And how does it differ between all the various services and locations Loganair offers? Our guest for that is Loganair's Flight Operations Manager, Stuart Houston, next time for episode 6 of Loganair's Flight Log. Find us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you usually listen, right here and on Loganair's own webpage. Remember, if you enjoyed Flight Log, please rate and recommend us, and please follow us if you have that option. That way, Flight Log will touch down with you whenever we publish a new episode. We'll see you next time for episode 6. Thanks for listening. So we're home.